Good evening, my name is Brian Hampton. I teach in the English department here at UTC and also coordinate the humanities program. On behalf of the C.S. Lewis Lecture Committee, and in gratitude to both the Chattanooga Christian Community Foundation and the UTC Speakers and Special Events Committee for funding this annual event now in its 25th year, I'm pleased to introduce our lecturer for tonight. As many of you know, the C.S. Lewis Lectureship was established in Chattanooga to perpetuate Lewis's distinguished academic and Christian ecumenical accomplishments. Over the years, the committee has sought after scholars whose work accords in some way with the spirit of C.S. Lewis's own vocation as a teacher devoted to the care of his pupils' minds and souls, as well as his legacy as literary critic, children's author, Christian apologist, and popular philosopher and theologian. In his last book, Letters to Malcolm, Lewis asserts that, quote, "We may ignore, but we can nowhere evade the presence of God," end quote. For him, human life, in its mostly mundane operations, and in its most deeply profound moments, can only find its potential in actively practicing the presence of God. Tonight we are honored to have in our presence one Christian academic whose significant body of work reflects precisely that spirit. Acknowledging with Lewis, as he puts it in Till We Have Faces, that, quote, "nothing is yet in its true form," end quote, our speaker is given to the ceaseless task of clarifying and articulating what that true form ought to look like in the interrelated realms of politics, ethics, gender relations, and the family, and from within the complex categories, rich traditions, and elegant theologies of the Christian faith. Like Lewis, Professor Elstein demonstrates her awareness of, quote, "the load or weight or burden," end quote, of her neighbor's glory. It is a glory which shines brokenly as through a lattice, but one which Lewis and Elstein would have us behold. "There are no ordinary people," Lewis states. "You have never talked to a mere mortal. All our dealings, all our play, all our politics must acknowledge that our neighbor is a creature in whom God has placed his image and likeness. In acknowledging this to be true, we discover that the weight or the burden of our own pilgrimage to glory is tied inevitably to theirs." Perusing the brochure that advertises our speaker, many of my colleagues and I can only hope that somewhere down the road, our accomplishments as academics and devoted family members will require as small a font as her prolific profile requires. Therefore, with pride and significant humility, please join me in welcoming our speaker, Professor Jean Bethke Elstein.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Brian, for that lovely introduction. It was very interesting to listen to, and introductions often aren't. I want to thank, you know what you've done, and so, you know, people repeat it to you, you already know it, so it was interesting to hear something different. I want to thank, in his absence, Professor Bill McClay, who first contacted me about this event, and who's an old friend. I'm serving with him now as a member of the National Endowment for the Humanities Council, and I've known him for a number of years, and I want to thank Doug, where are you, Doug? Doug Kutz and Terry Morrison from InterVarsity, who has helped to organize this event, the multiple sponsors of this event. Some of you may know, most of you surely do not, that although I teach at the University of Chicago, the family home is in Nashville. So I actually commute every week, Nashville to Chicago. I've been doing that now for, I think this is my 13th year. So I'm really just is up the road a piece from you, and we've come down here a number of times to Chattanooga. It's a beautiful city. The grandkids love it because of the Children's Museum, the aquarium, and so on. So I'm always happy to come back here. And with that, let me simply go to our topic for the evening. It's hard to go wrong with C.S. Lewis, and I hope that what I have culled from his very interesting essay, not his best-known work, but his very interesting essay, The Abolition of Man, will help to raise some questions for our mutual consideration. In March 2005, the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine published an essay on the topic of euthanasia for newborns, printing up something called the Groningen Protocol for such procedures. Groningen is the name of a town in Holland where these protocols were agreed upon. The New York Times Magazine, July 10, 2005, reprinted those protocols under the heading Euthanasia for Babies? Going on to ask, is this humane or barbaric? Now, this way of presenting alternatives in the guise of neutrality is typical of much opinion, humane or barbaric. I suspect that all of us know that the average reader of the New York Times prefers to choose the humane, not the barbaric, alternative. And the humane course, it turns out, is the one that favors infanticide if the correct procedures are followed. Euthanizing babies under such circumstances is the way of reason, we are told, and those who argue we must not cross that line advance what the essayist calls sentiment, which he equates to unreason. Now, the essayist asks the reader to imagine a heated dining room table argument about these matters. The way of reason, he tells us, requires unflinching honesty. By contrast, moral sentiments are inertial, resisting, in his words, the force of moral reason. And the essay concludes in this way. Just quote Verhagen. Verhagen is the Dutch doctor who identifies himself as a pro-infant euthanasia practicer. He says, just quote Verhagen's description of the medically induced deaths over which he has presided. It's beautiful in a way, says Dr. Verhagen. It is after they die that you see them relaxed for the first time. And even, the essay continues, the most spirited dining room table debate over moral progress will, for the moment, fall silent. The end of the quote from the essay. Now, the author, a fellow named James Holt, obviously wants us to imagine the hushed atmosphere as one in which diners are overwhelmed by the vision of peace at last for infants born with disabilities, congenitally deformed infants. But I suspect that many of us in the room here tonight will fall silent from contemplating the horror of it. Because in effect, what is being said here is, let's give these perturbed little spirits some peace, let's kill them. Now, Holt apparently believes, the essayist, that brutal candor about such matters is the ethically preferred route. Yes, we're killing them, it's the right thing to do, rather than the course that may involve permitting multiply handicapped infants to die rather than using sustained heroic measures to keep them alive, for example. There's a big distinction between these two. But the latter, the course of not continuing endlessly with heroic measures, that's called by the essayist casuistic confusion. So any course that reflects our moral uneasiness is dishonest. Any course that makes it easier for medical personnel to euthanize handicapped infants is considered honest and reasoned. Now, does anyone doubt what C.S. Lewis might say about this, about the way in which healers become killers? Those of you somewhat familiar with my work will know that these are issues that have long troubled me. I have worried in print that in the name of enlightenment, we are eliminating whole categories of persons. For example, so overwhelming is our cultural animus against the less than perfect that nearly 90% of pregnancies that test positive for Down syndrome are aborted in the United States today, all under the rubric of choice. So in the name of expanding choice and eliminating suffering, we are, perhaps, is something we need to think about, narrowing our definition of humanity and, along the way, felt responsibility to create welcoming environments for all children. Indeed, medical experts now argue, this happened about 2 months ago, that all pregnant women, not just those in at-risk categories, should be tested routinely for Down syndrome in order that fetuses that test positive might be aborted at an earlier stage in the pregnancy, given the more sophisticated tests now available. Now, when we aim to eliminate, whether through systematic euthanasia or selective aborting of flawed fetuses, one version of humanity, perhaps suffering humanity, but humanity nonetheless, we dangerously constrict the boundaries of the moral community. In his posthumously published Ethics, the anti-Nazi theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer insisted that the most radical excision of the integrity and right of natural life is what Bonhoeffer calls arbitrary killing, and he defines that as the deliberate destruction of innocent life. He goes on, "The right to live is a matter of the essence and not, he tells us, of any socially imposed or constructed values. For even the most wretched life is worth living before God." That's the end of Bonhoeffer's quote. Now, as with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, C.S. Lewis was writing under the shadows of Nazism and Stalinism. His essay, The Abolition of Man, published in 1944, and subtitled Reflections on Education with Special Reference to the Teaching of English in the Upper Forms of Schools, would seem at first glance to have very little to do with the grave matters with which I have begun this lecture. That turns out not to be so, because Lewis sees dangerous tendencies in, of all places, the elementary textbooks of his time. At first puzzling, this slowly makes sense as we read along, because a general cultural milieu, a culture's mores, its habits of the heart, as that great observer of the American democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville, put it, these habits of the heart are always embedded and embodied in the books we require our children to read and the books we use to teach them. Now, what on earth was going on with English textbooks such that C.S. Lewis would take note of them? Well, first, he detects an embrace of what he calls subjectivism, which means, speaking epistemologically, that is, about how we come to know things and so on and defend what we know, that means the embrace, and I will explain each of these, the embrace of both positivism and emotivism. Again, I will explain each. 1944 and the immediate post-war decades were the heyday of this approach, and it had clearly made its way into elementary schools, even as it was the dominant approach to the teaching of philosophy at Great Britain's elite institutions of higher learning. Now, the reduction of values to subjective feelings, that sentiment as opposed to reason, of which the New York Times piece speaks, leads to the embrace, or itself is a fruit of the embrace, of two interlocked propositions. And these are summarized by Lewis in the following way. First, that all sentences containing a predicate of values are statements about the emotional state of the speaker. And second, that all such statements are unimportant. Now, one need not refer to the general philosophy at work that all values are subjective and trivial in order to promulgate this philosophy. Indeed, many textbook authors probably do not recognize what they are doing to the school child, Lewis suggests. Certainly, the school child cannot know, he tells us, what is being done to him. And in this way, another in his little portion of the human heritage has been quietly taken from them before they are old enough to understand. Now, let me provide an illustration of this from my own experience. When our daughter Jenny was in the fifth grade in a public school in the town in which we then lived, one of those New England college towns in which university students outnumber permanent residents, she was required to complete a worksheet on distinguishing facts from values, values being understood in the way that Lewis is criticizing as subjective opinions having no cognitive status, hence no defensible truth warrants. Now, Jenny read aloud as she did this, and as she was trying to figure things out. Her mother, myself, got a bit agitated, as I tend to do when confronted with this sort of thing. So, to help her understand, I said, well, Jenny, if I say something is wrong, does that mean I'm stating a fact or a value? Values, to repeat, being the things we all have, and one cannot distinguish between them. They all come out of the same kind of subjectivist stew. Well, predictably, Jenny answered it would be a value. And then I continue, well, Martin Luther King said racial segregation was wrong. Slavery was wrong. Suppose there's someone who says slavery is a good thing, segregation is a good thing. We should bring each of these back. Couldn't we say that that person is wrong? And Martin Luther King is right, and that slavery and segregation are bad, period. And Jenny was stumped for a moment, and she was troubled. And then she said, well, I think slavery and segregation are wrong, too, but that's just my opinion. Now, our discussion didn't end there, of course, but this experience reinforces Lewis's claim concerning the pervasiveness of the sorts of teachings he criticizes in his essay. For Lewis, when ordinary human feelings are set up as contrary to reason, we are on very dangerous ground indeed for a botched treatment of what he calls some basic human emotion is not only bad literature, it is moral treachery to boot. In his words, by starving the sensibility of our pupils, we only make them easier prey to the propagandist when he comes. Now, Lewis insists that in Platonic, Aristotelian, Stoic, Christian, and some other Eastern religions, one finds in common, in his words, the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we are, right? And Lewis calls this simply the Tao, T-A-O. That is, there are certain transcultural universal claims, all right? Now, emotional states, he follows, can be reasonable or unreasonable. They're not unreasonable by definition, for one must not traffic in the false distinction between reason and emotion, rationality, and sentiment. Now, in the dominant approach that he's criticizing, positivism, by contrast, quote, the world of facts without one trace of value and the world of feelings without one trace of truth or falsehood, justice or injustice, confront one another and no rapprochement, no coming together is possible. And he calls this a ghastly simplicity. Let me give you another example drawn from experience. When I was a graduate student in the late 1960s and early 1970s, this ghastly simplicity was the reigning approach. I have to say I never quite got it. And when I tried to argue the point with my professors, having at that time no formal training in epistemology, it was really a non-starter. It was clear that positivism, the approach, was not up for debate, but rather it was to be taken for granted. It's the place you start from. You don't question it, you don't challenge it. This may be one reason I wound up as a political theorist, for in a world in which allegedly a scientific approach dictates the severance of fact from value, political theorists, political philosophers are seen as a kind of strange breed apart who specialize in evaluation or normative claims. And these sorts of things, again, are not defensible rationally. So we're regarded as a bit fuzzy-minded by definition by those who push this approach. Now, for a time, I believed over-optimistically, as it turns out, that the decisive critique of this approach, mounted by philosophers such as Charles Taylor, who just won the much-coveted Templeton Prize, Alistair MacIntyre, among others, that they had really critiqued positivism so decisively that it was finished. Turns out not to be so. This orientation reappeared with gusto in the current dominant epistemology in the social sciences, at most institutions, my own included, so-called rational choice theory. Now is not the time to unpack rational choice. Some of us call it rat choice. In any detail, suffice to say that expanded to become a total worldview, this is the problem, expanded to become a Weltanschauung rather than utilized as a relatively modest approach to a finite series of decision-making processes, rat choice trivializes all statements of value. They have no truth, warrant, or claim. And it further enshrines a reductive view of the human person as the sum total of his or her preferences, her calculations of marginal utility, for, according to this approach, one cannot make substantive distinctions between different utilities, between, say, polishing one's Porsche or working in a hospice. Can't distinguish between them. Each person is maximizing his utility. Now, within a universe defined by this choice, everything in principle can be reduced to utility. Everything in principle can be commodified. Everything in principle has a price rather than a value. Any restrictions human societies draw on where preference might take us are arbitrary. There are no intrinsic goods or evils at all. Nothing is valued for its own sake. True, we may value babies in a certain way. It's an ancient sentiment, we are told, but it has no rational content. Instead, every value is reducible to a preference and describable in the language of maximizing utility. Let me give you another illustration. Years ago, when I was teaching at a university, not one where I'm now teaching, an eager candidate for a political science job gave his talk. And to him, everything was a preference. He really was embedded in this approach. There was no other way to talk about politics, no other way to talk about the moral life. Now, when he had finished, I asked, it's a curious thing, is it not, when Martin Luther King delivered his great speech, he cried, "I have a dream, not I have a preference." How do you explain this? Is there a difference? And the somewhat flustered young man indicated that what King was calling a dream was at base just another preference. And so there was no difference in principle from that and, say, debating marginal alterations in the price of commodities. Now, this way of thinking makes that hash of our moral sentiments, of our God-given capacity to reason about that which is good, to which Lewis referred in 1944. This surely is what he feared, feared that something precious and irreparable was being lost. Those debunking the normative status and truth warrants of claims of value, whether then or now, are, he tells us, promoting values of their own. Writes Lewis, a great many of those who debunk traditional, or as they would say, sentimental values, have in the background values of their own, which they believe to be immune from the debunking process. End of quote. One thinks here of the fundamentalist skeptic who was skeptical of everything save his fundamentalism. Or his skepticism, I should say. Not his fundamentalism, his skepticism. Skeptical of everything but skepticism. Or the proclaimer of moral relativism who relativizes everything except his claim to moral relativism. Now, Lewis feared that in his era, and we should fear it in our own, then and now, what seems to matter is not the dignity of each and every human life, but rather goals like maximizing reproductive capacities in their optimal form, and less than perfect or ill newborns will never maximize their reproductive potential. So they are without value, or their value is lowered, it's lessened. Two, many of them will never contribute to production. So they will have no value in the marketplace. They will be worthless in the marketplace. So that, too, means they are without value, or they are of reduced value. We might attach value to them arbitrarily as an emotion, but this is not a reasoned position. Now, it is interesting and troubling that we are in the age of human rights par excellence, and yet there are forces at work in our world that undermine the fundamental claims of human dignity that must ground a decent, robust regime of human rights. Some excisions of our humanity at present are obvious and in the headlines, blatant stuff that we can all recognize. For example, in fatwa after fatwa, Osama bin Laden's claim that, quote, I'm quoting him, of course, Americans, Jews, and infidels, and then he goes on to say, should be slaughtered whenever and wherever they are to be found, close quote. This means men, women, children, armed or unarmed, wherever they are to be found. We see the problem immediately. Categories of humanity stripped of all rights rhetorically and in the actual practice of those inflamed by this sort of rhetoric. But there are other forces at work undermining the ground of human dignity by eroding the full force of our humanity, whether whole or broken, normal or abnormal, young or old, that are less obvious. For example, if we totalize, we make it the whole world view, a kind of population biology perspective or an econometric perspective, value is whatever market price is attached. These are two of the ways we have devised to do this. These approaches, which are utilitarian at base, have even worked their way into some medical thought and practice, including a utilitarian approach to the field of medical ethics, where we find some who believe that you can actually tote up the value, the disparate value, of particular human lives, and then make a determination as to who is a more valuable candidate for, let's say, an organ transplant, so that those with Down syndrome people, those with mental retardation, do not deserve a transplant as much as someone who has a genius IQ. Now, I appreciate that many who share the view that seriously deformed infants should be euthanized, whether in furtherance of a particular approach or agenda, or given a generalized antipathy toward the deformed, will no doubt be horrified by my remarks. They will insist, are being humane. They want to prevent useless suffering. Those of us working to counter the pressures at work in this matter should acknowledge those urgencies. The people one opposes are not monsters, for the most part. There are surely some who wield the needles bearing death who are. like the notorious Dr. Jack Kevorkian, Dr. Death, with his necrophiliac obsessions and his admiration of Nazi experimentation on helpless death camp inmates. But the vast majority want to do the right thing. Now, Lewis understood this, understood that various ideologies, including contemporary right to die, as it's called, are, quote, arbitrarily wrenched from their context in the whole. And here his references to those fundamental truths that he's called the Tao, that includes a premise about human dignity. And then he tells us, wrenched from the whole, they're swollen to madness in their isolation. That is, you take a little piece of the truth. For example, there's certainly some truth to the way in which people approach economic decision-making, but then you make that the totality of what makes us tick. There's nothing to counter or constrain the approach, and it becomes swollen, he says, to madness. And in this way, fundamental claims to human value as such are weakened or they are reduced to superstition. For, in his words, the Nietzschean ethic, that is, the will to power, a triumph of the most powerful, can be accepted only if we are ready to scrap traditional morals as a mere error and to put ourselves in a position where we can find no solid ground for any value judgments at all. Now, at this point in his essay, Lewis turns explicitly to our conquest of nature, the way people in his era heralded a coming age of human triumph over nature's arbitrariness. Now, his examples of this conquest were, and I'm sure if you haven't read the essay, you'll be surprised at the list, the aeroplane, the wireless, and the contraceptive. Now, I appreciate how hopelessly archaic this sounds to our contemporary ears. One has to probe deeply to make sense of it all, rather than to eliminate Lewis as a cranky fuddy-duddy in these matters. Now, I'm not going to talk much about the wireless and the aeroplane. Those had to do with the notion of eclipsing a sense of wonder at the world itself, at nature. We eclipse the distance between people. We disembody people. We think that we can relate to sort of entities with whom we have no concrete relationship. If you think of some of the notions now of having a community of people on the internet, people who don't know one another, who may be using fake names, I think you get some idea of the worry that he has. A real community has to do with dealing with real human beings and all their messiness. Now let's take contraception as the example for closer examination. Lewis says, the living deny existence to the not yet living through this method. And he goes on to say, we believe we can engage in selective breeding with nature as its instrument. Now, these are harsh words, you might think, but consider this exercise of power, or perhaps better put, the way this power is to be exercised, implies, he says, the power to make its descendants what it pleases. For each new power won by man over nature is a power over man as well. Each advance leaves him weaker as well as stronger. The final stages come when man, by eugenics, by prenatal conditioning, and by an education and propaganda based on perfect applied psychology, has obtained full control over himself. Human nature will be the last part of nature to surrender to man. That's the quote. Now, again, remember the context, 1944, Nazi biopolitics, state-mandated eugenics, killing all of the worthless, and encouraging selective breeding to get a master race and so on. All of these things are things he's fretting about. Now, he held out the hope that the obstinacy of real mothers and, above all, real children might preserve the human race in such sanity as it still possesses. But the man-molders of the new age will be armed with the power of an omnicompetent state and an irresistible scientific technique. We shall get at last a race of conditioners who really can cut out all posterity in what shape they please. That was his worry, the notion of birth control as a kind of mandated system under state power. and the way in which you would start to, this eugenics project would creep in. Now, at the time, the reference point his readers could point to was Nazi Germany, with its cruelly enforced eugenics, and this certainly was in his mind. I doubt that many suspected that their own societies might have entered into this danger zone, not under the banner of totalitarianism, but under the rubric of human choice and freedom. And this is indeed, by the way, what happened. There were eugenics, pro-eugenics laws in many Western democracies. In the United States in the 20s and 30s, we had states passing coercive sterilization bills to coercively sterilize the unfit, very loose definition of what that involved, and so on. So Lewis had reason to worry about all this. And he fretted then about post-humanity, a bleak future. And we, of course, have our own apostles of the post or transhuman future. Now, when he wrote in 1944 of the abolition of man, he meant the end of humanity as we know it. There may still be this biological entity, but the end of the human person, as we have come to understand him and her, brought about by our own humanity, if you will, brought about by our own projects and our inability to stem what St. Augustine called the lust to dominate over others, to dominate over circumstances, to dominate finally over our own natures. This can take such obviously disgusting and evil forms as death camps and gulags. But it can also appear in other guises and in the name of doing good. Now, I am not trafficking in moral equivalences here. I'm not saying the contemporary positive genetic enhancement, as it is called, is identical to the intentional slaughter of millions of people because of their allegedly underhuman, untermenschen status. But I am alerting us to what I believe to be some very real dangers in our world at the moment. Now, these projects of self-overcoming, including biological self-overcoming, are tricky to get at critically precisely because they are not so manifestly hideous as the horrors of the 20th century, because they present themselves to us in the dominant language of our culture, consent, control, choice, and because they promise an escape from the frailties, the finitude, the incompleteness of our human condition into a realm of near mastery. So we become beguiled with the notion of a new self. We'll take the genetic material and we'll perfect it. We'll find ways to sort of weed out the less than perfect. We'll enhance the good. We won't do something as obvious as the Nazis did as killing off the unfit, but we will find ways to sort of move beyond these statuses and using a variety of means. Consider then that we are in the throes, it seems to me, of a structure of biological obsession that undermines recognition of the fullness and the limitations of human embodiment. For example, a premise and promise driving the Human Genome Project, I'm not saying I was opposed to it, I just wanted to get at one underlying premise, was that we might one day intervene decisively in order to promote better human products. And those who saw in the Human Genome Project that possibility ran to the ecstatic. For example, in 1986, a pronouncement by a geneticist that the Genome Project is, quote, the holy grail of human genetics, the ultimate answer to the commandment to know thyself. So you know as much as you can about the RNA, DNA, and you know a human being. Now, in the imaginations of those who want to construct this gleaming new person without flaws, the human body is something that we make and unmake and remake at will. And I suspect that we are increasingly loath to grant the status of givenness to any aspect of ourselves, despite the fact that human babies are complex little bodies, pre-programmed with all sorts of delicately calibrated reactions to the human relationships that nature presumes will be the matrix of child nurture. If we think of bodies concretely in this way, then we are propelled to ask ourselves questions about the worlds these little bodies enter. Is this world welcoming? Is it warm? Is it responsive? If we tilt in the direction of a genetic fundamentalism, in which the body is raw material to be worked over, the surroundings in which bodies are situated fades, and the body gets enshrined as a kind of messianic project. It is unsurprising, therefore, that certain experts declare, as a matter of fact, the point for them isn't even worth arguing, we, quote, must inevitably start to choose our descendants. We do so now in permitting or preventing the births of our own children according to their genetic prognosis, thus selecting the lives to come, close quote. That's exactly the sort of thing Lewis was fretting about. Now, so long this view holds, as our freedom of action is not cramped, we will stay on the road of progress and exercise sovereign choice over birth by consigning to non-existent existence those with a less than stellar potential for a life that is less worth living than those of the more genetically perfect. So what C.S. Lewis called the extreme rationality, which is not to be confused with reason as such, the extreme rationality that consigns to the dustbin of history all claims of intrinsic value, as those embracing such truths cannot allegedly meet standards of a rationalistic defense of those values, such people wind up promoting a subjectivism of values they believe is more honest. But when this happens, those whose values triumph will be those with the most relentless, overwhelming will to power. We will find no way to counter them. By contrast, Lewis tells us, in his words, a dogmatic, as in a set of organized beliefs, a dogmatic belief in objective value is necessary to the very idea of a rule which is not tyranny, or an obedience which is not slavery. Let me read that one more time. A dogmatic belief in objective value is necessary to the very idea of a rule which is not tyranny or an obedience, which is not slavery. Now, we seem to have moved rather far from the real-world drama of a disabled newborn being intentionally euthanized. But I hope that you find this not to be the case. I hope that you see in the establishment and even celebration of deliberate infanticide as the only courageous and humane thing to do with infants who are born with disabilities, is what reason dictates. I hope you see in that the sort of thing that Lewis warned us against in 1944. Why can we not love a helpless being in the time that God has given her? What can this profoundly disabled newborn teach us about grace and beauty and goodness, about caritas? Why can we not ameliorate pain and discomfort without believing we must either use extraordinary measures to keep alive or else boldly kill? In 2003, the 18-year-old son of one of my cousins died. He was supposed to have died when he was an infant. He was born anencephalic. He could never speak. He could not feed himself. He could not crawl. He could not walk. He could not do any of the things normal human beings generally do or learn to do. Now, according to the doctors, there was really no there. He didn't have a brain in the usual sense. There was no there. There was no real person there. Aaron was definitely a prime candidate for euthanizing, or as the moral theorist Peter Singer candidly puts it in approval, infanticide. But to anyone who met him, Aaron was a beautiful child with the biggest blue eyes and the most striking dark eyelashes imaginable. He stared out at the world, making no apparent distinctions until his mother came into view. And then his face would beam, it would light up. I don't know any other way to describe it. He knew her and he loved her, and I would defy anyone to claim otherwise. And her love and care and devotion kept him going for 18 years. And when he died, an entire family, parents, sibling, grandparents, aunt, uncles, cousins, and an entire community mourned their loss. Now, my cousin, Paula Jean, did not bemoan her fate. She did not curse God or wonder what might have been if Aaron had been perfect. This had been given to her, and she would do her job joyfully. And in those 18 years, this young man who could not move on his own never once developed a bed sore. Now, the story of Aaron and Paula Jean is a story of human endurance and the receipt of the gift of grace. And I ask you to contrast this to the vision of peace promulgated by the euthanasia doctor who extols how beautiful are handicapped newborns who have been killed intentionally. These are two contrasting visions of our shared human future. One in which human beings will write perhaps the decisive chapter in which we will abolish man, that is, obliterate that which is truly human, or by contrast, remember how to love and to cherish our humanity, however wretched, however broken. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Now of Q&A, and Professor Elshtain wishes to field her own questions, so I will hand it back to her.
Thank you. Well, we have time for questions, and yes, I see a hand up immediately. Please.
Your whole talk focused on the beginnings of life.
Yes.
In America today, I see politically and socially that people are ignoring what you have said in the continuation of life.
Yes.
Some people are born with substance abuse tendencies. This is an inborn characteristic, I am sure, because I've worked with many of them. Some people are born with learning disabilities, which do not allow them to understand the world the way I do, by any means, or the way probably anyone in this room can.
Yeah.
There are people who are born with impulse control disorders. They end up in prison, and at that point, they have lost their humanity in American society. We treat them far less than humans. Many people find animals more pitiable than these humans. The poor in America are treated far less because they are the ones with the learning disabilities, with the impulsivity, with a lack of ability to plan for the future and prepare for it. In our prison systems, most of the prisoners are learning disabled as well as having alcohol or drug or both problems.
Right. And your question?
These
yeah.
people are yeah. not seen. And my question is,
right.
what do we do with your humanity for the rest of humanity? It goes beyond birth. Have these children, now what do we do with them? We cannot have a health system which says, because you didn't earn enough, you die. Because you have a problem with alcohol and drug abuse, you got some
okay.
trouble, you go to prison, and you die.
Got it. Well, thank you for your question. I thought initially that you were going to... I'm going to answer first the question I imagined you were going to ask, and then I'll answer your question. The question I imagined you were going to ask when you mentioned end of life was, isn't there a problem with how we are starting to think about the elderly? about those who have become helpless and infirm toward the end of their lives. And I was going to say, yes, indeed, that Lewis's essay helps us to understand that as well. And I think my analysis of his essay helps us to understand that. Because if you limit value to worth that can be measured or commodified, then those who can no longer contribute in a certain way, their value correlatively decreases. And you have, again, a right to die movement that starts to come in to say that the elderly should be able to voluntarily euthanize themselves when they are no longer productive. And I think we know from the experience in the Netherlands that what is supposed to be, the documentation on this is by now considerable, that what was supposed to be entirely choice, whether to be euthanized or not, that it is that there's killing of patients in hospitals and so on that goes in without anything like informed choice. I'd still be opposed even with informed choice, but that's happening. And those of you interested, I could refer you to a couple of Dutch ethicists who've written about this and what is so troubling when euthanasia comes under the control of a state apparatus and doctors then are enjoined to become killers. There are many elderly in the Netherlands today who are afraid to go to a hospital because they're afraid they'll be euthanized. Now, that was a question I thought you were going to ask. Let me go to the question you asked, which is consisted, first of all, of a characterization of our situation. And then you said, are these not, in effect, examples of the way in which we reckon people less than fully human who are in these variety of circumstances? And I think that there, Lewis would, in fact, ask us to ask ourselves, you know, what is the society's overarching system of value? What do we value? St. Augustine would say, what do we love in common? That was Augustine's way of distinguishing between different human societies. Is this love sort of rightly ordered, or is it disordered? Think of what we love in common. And I think out of an exercise like that, a whole range of concerns will come up about how people are well or ill treated, how they are valued or disvalued. And you offered up some of your own examples and concerns of that. And I think his essay would help, what helps us to sort of discipline our thinking about those issues. Now, that said, let me go on to say, and I think Lewis would be the first to say this, that we have, let's say, a statement, a fundamental statement of certain truths, certain values that we might share. It's often very difficult. It's not so easy to go from that to what we take to be, in the case of government policy, appropriate public policies to respond to that concern. That's often not so easy. That's what we're going to get, as the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr argued in the 20th century, that's where we're going to get a lot of disagreement. People who share the same goal but have profound disagreements on how best to ameliorate a certain condition, how best to respond to a certain situation. So I'm alerting us to this just because it is the case that we are still going to have disagreements, even if we agree on the core of values, over how we can best deal with this whole range of issues and how we evaluate them as more or less significant. Which do we think, in a sense, triaging our concerns? Because you can't deal with equal intensity with everything at the same time. So what seems the most critical issue? How do we think about that? What can we do about that? What kinds of interventions can be made? On what level? Is this something individuals should do with the support of families and churches? Is it a civil society concern for organizations in the society? Is it a governmental concern, and so on? So I think Lewis didn't write about those kinds of things very much. But those are the kinds of questions, if you're concerned about political issues, that will start to occur to you when you begin to reflect on his essay and the direction that a society is going. And I think that in given the core of questions that I brought up in my talk, that one of the things Lewis would say is something like this. We may not know how, because we're flawed and imperfect creatures, how best to get from A to Z as far as a concern and a goal, what policies will get us there. But we certainly know enough to say we should stop doing this. We know enough to say that. We know enough to say we will never take the step to cloning for reproduction. We must stop before we get to that. Right? We know enough to say that. That doesn't require huge sums of money. What it requires is the moral courage to say no, that there are some things that we can do that we ought not to do. And if we do them, it gets us closer to this loss of our humanity that Lewis talked about. So I think we can then start to think about those issues that can be dealt with by us simply saying, we draw the line here. We are not going to go there. We will not do this. Even though, as you may know, we have a pretty active lobby, number of lobbies in America today favoring cloning. We even have some law professors writing on the rights of clonees before they exist. We have some people who have imagined a future in which we clone human beings and keep them alive for spare parts. And then we kill them and use their organs and so forth. So these are not science fiction examples. These are the kinds of things that are happening right now where, again, you don't have to have a societal-wide consensus on a big program. What you need is the moral courage to say, stop. Yes, right there. No, hold on. Say again. There are some schools of thought that support.
There are some schools of thought that support a different set of values that value one.
Yes.
I just wondered if you could elaborate a little on that.
Yes. Yes.
And how this event is supported.
Right. Okay. Well, certainly that's Lewis's position, as you know. And he argues something like this, that if we reflect on our natures, on the kinds of creatures that we are, if we engage in processes of discernment, we can come up with some understandings about what is good, the good of a human being, and what's bad for human beings. Arbitrary, capricious killing or mistreatment of human beings clearly is bad. Caring for those who need our care, helping one another, we're social creatures, that's good. We've always been social creatures. That's the way in which we come to understand ourselves. That's the way in which societies, when they're working well, are organized. There are institutions that help to sustain our capacity to care for one another. So you can get a good bit of the distance that way by engaging in that kind of reflection. In the history of Western philosophy, we talk about natural right, natural law. These are the sorts of things that are in the background for Lewis. They don't necessarily require any set of revealed truths. But he would, of course, go on to add that if you want the full truth of the human person, that truth is revealed in and through faith. That truth is revealed through the gift of God to us, of the Christian Savior, to what he offers to human beings in his death, in his incarnation, his crucifixion and his resurrection, the gift of grace. All of that makes available to us the fullness of understanding that we would lack otherwise. So in this, he shares with St. Augustine the view that this is not irrational or unreasoning. It's not like you get to, you take four steps and you say, okay, I'm going to be irrational from now on. You know, you reason to number four and then you say, okay, now it's time for lack of reason. No. Augustine's formulation was credo ut intelligam, I believe in order to understand, faith seeking understanding. How I can open up things and learn things and come to understand things I couldn't otherwise understand. And Augustine tells us in his Confessions, one reason he left the group that he'd been associated with called the Manichees, the Manicheans, who had a dualistic conception of philosophy and of the world, was because, he says, I could make no progress in it. I couldn't understand what I wanted and needed to understand. So it's a huge mistake to do what the people that Lewis is criticizing have done, which is to say anyone who is thinking with or through faith is committed to irrationalism. No, Lewis says, no. What this does is to enhance and deepen our capacity to understand. Now, let me add one other piece to this, and that is that he would say, but I understand we live in a world with all sorts of people who aren't Christians. But he's got that notion of this cluster, this core of values, that he believes are shared by many philosophies and many religions. And one of them has to do with the intrinsic value of the person. One of them has to do with an understanding of human dignity, such that people are not to be arbitrarily ill-dignified and so on. Certain basic themes. One has to do with the fact that human beings do not fully control the world, never did and never will, and shouldn't aspire to that. Now, I haven't fully answered your question, but if that helps to get sort of the direction that your question tends, there's more, but let me stop with that. I'm going to get students first, if that's okay. Let me get this young man here, and then I'll go to you. Yes?
Thank you. I'm a graduate student in a philosophy department that's sort of teeming with secular Kantians who are very willing to take seriously the concerns of many rational persons, but who don't think that there is moral value possessed by non-personal beings or non-rational beings. And so I'm wondering if you could give some additional suggestions perhaps for how I or others like me might urge some of these points.
Kantianism, of course, is an approach to moral philosophy called deontology, which means there are certain rules, certain duties. What sort of human being are you imagining is one who can come to know and believe these moral imperatives? That if you say you can deal, excuse me for getting philosophical for a second, if you say you can deal with the epistemological question, that which I come to know, without dealing with the knower, or we would say ontological question, the kind of being we are, you're going to have an incomplete, at best, moral philosophy. You cannot just bracket the question about what kind of beings we are. You cannot bracket that question. It just does not work. And I think one of the issues that's come back on the table in a big, big way after the horrors of the 20th century, when neither Kantianism nor utilitarianism rose to save us, and in certain areas Christianity did a pretty poor job too, is the fact that you cannot speak about human rights without speaking of the kind of human being who is the object of rights and who carries rights. You cannot do that. And that being the case, then one is under an obligation to spell out explicitly one's anthropology in the sense of one's understanding of what's human, anthropos logos, understanding of the human, and that is really at the heart of how we think about ethics. So that would be one issue. Let me just add this, and then I'll get another question, and that is that in his ethics, and an essay that's part of the ethics called What Does It Mean to Tell the Truth? Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who, as you know, was an anti-Nazi theologian and paid with his life, was hanged by the Gestapo April 9, 1945. Bonhoeffer makes some very severe criticisms of Kant because one of the arguments that Kant makes is that I am obliged at all times to tell the absolute truth, which means if a murderer comes to the door inquiring about the whereabouts of my friend, whom he intends to slaughter, and my friend is in my apartment, I'm obliged to tell him the truth, that my friend is there. And Bonhoeffer says, this makes of the moral philosopher a tormentor of humanity. That in fact, the Christian response would be, in the name of caritas, in the name of love of the friend, would be to send the murderer down another pathway and then to confess before God the fact that you had, in fact, on this occasion, given the well-being and life of another human being, that you had told a, you had you know, uttered a falsehood to this would-be murderer. That that's the pathway of love for others. So I think you can see some of the distinctions between the kind of severity of a certain sort of Kantian ethic and I think the far more humane, if you will, approach of a Christian ethic, which makes provision for our shortcomings, recognizes that there are times when there's no easy answer, times when, as Bonhoeffer says, our hands will get dirty, as his did, participating in the conspiracy to kill Hitler. And at that point, we throw ourselves on God's grace and mercy. Yes, sir, right here.
Ma'am, would you care to give us your take on the rule in Wade? That's what my... We have the brief view of Martin.
Roe v. Wade? Yeah. Well, I think that one of the issues that came in with Roe v. Wade, one of the concerns in 1973, was that you in fact set up as nearly absolute the right of the mother in concert with a physician to make a determination about to in effect on demand receive an abortion. And there was very little attention paid, indeed none, to the whole question of the moral status of the unborn child. So the result of that has been that the United States has the most permissive abortion regime of the Western societies nowadays. That in fact there's more regulation, more recognition of the moral complexities of that issue in European societies. My friend Marianne Glendon has written a book about that, comparing abortion laws and abortion regimes in different Western societies. And I think what would trouble Lewis was not just that the argument at the time, which I remember very, very well indeed, was that having an abortion was, I remember one discussion I was part of at a conference, a feminist conference, was not any different from having a tooth pulled. You know, it's a physical thing. This entity, which is called the product of conception, has no moral worth, no moral status. And I think that's where the danger came in. That's where the danger came in. Because once you start to say, this being has no moral status, then it's easier to go from that to say, well, what about these born babies that have problems? Well, they don't have a moral status either. You know, we can, as Dr. Singer from Princeton says, we can, parents should have the right to euthanize their newborns if they decide they don't want this one. And he said in an article, in an interview actually, in a journal published in London, which I read to greater and greater amazement as I read and shock as I read it, that if he were confronted with a situation where a barn was burning and you had a child with mental retardation in the barn or a normal animal of some kind, let's say a normal chimpanzee, which would you save? And he says, the animal. You would do that. He said, now, maybe if this mentally retarded child had a, you know, parents who really cared for him, they'd be kind of upset, so, you know, but if it were just he, in the absence of any other knowledge other than normal animal, child with mental deficiencies, you take the animal. So I think that these are the kinds of things that become deeply, deeply troubling. How about if I take one more question? I know it's very warm in here, by the way. So, well, there are two, both of you. A young lady first and then a young gentleman.
I was wondering, what about someone that is brain dead?
Someone what? Yeah. The question about brain death, where, you know, there's no higher level cognitive function, clearly confronts us now. In decisions, situations where families often have harrowing decisions to make about what to do with a person who is brain dead. Now, in order to say something about that, one needs more information. Is the brain dead person breathing on her own? Is she capable of taking nourishment? Is she comatose or is she awake? Has periods of awakeness? You know, is the person otherwise healthy, so on and so forth. You'd want to have more details on that. Is the person being kept alive through all kinds of complex artificial means, and if these were withdrawn, the person would die immediately? You know, we would need more information. I'm very loath to say, here's the bright line, and, you know, yes or no, yes or no. Often in these situations, it's not like that. I think that it's very worrying to lay down an absolute rule that, by definition, brain dead people can be euthanized. Because we're talking about euthanasia, right? We're talking about euthanasia. That is a route down which I believe we should never go. So then the question becomes, do you withhold food and hydration and watch the person die? I don't think food and hydration are extraordinary needs. Then the question would be, if the person's on a heart-lung machine, if the person can't breathe, are those extraordinary measures? Yes, they are. Then you've got a different set of considerations that come into play. But Lewis would certainly worry, and so do I, about anything that makes it really easy for us to kill other people. Yes, young gentleman right here.
From Lewis's how would he address the condition of sin?
Well, certainly, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to take a swing. It's about sin. How would he address the condition of sin with reference to his prognostications about the future of man? Did I get that right? Well, I think we can reasonably say that in the kinds of situations that he describes in his essay, and that I have repeated here tonight, he would certainly see human sinfulness of various sorts at work. Our capacity for denial of the truth, our capacity for knowingly misjudging the good of human beings and human self-worth, our sort of sinful pride and arrogance that leads us to take one little piece of a perspective and say, now I understand everything, there are no mysteries left. Certainly he would see human pridefulness, which is to say sin of a certain kind at work in all these situations. Now, he would also want to say to you, and I think say to us, that, you know, this is the way Christians talk about these things with one another. But we also have to be able to make an argument to those who are not Christian about why certain things are bad. Bad for everybody. Not just bad for Christians, bad for everybody. Bad for a society. That they make, if we start to euthanize newborns with disabilities or disfigurement, what's going to start to count as a disfigurement? You know, we'll say, well, we'll get rid of this category, we'll get rid of this category, and then pretty soon, you know, as some people have written, we'll say, well, this person's going to be too short, this person's going to be, you know, we start to normalize these things, and in fact, there's talk about, a lot of discussion about selecting for height, selecting for all these other qualities and thinking about a kind of positive eugenics. So this stuff isn't that far-fetched, and I think that's a huge worry, and certainly Lewis would want us to fret about that, and to be able to appeal to people who don't share our faith. Because when you live in a pluralistic society, you've got to do that. We have to appeal to other people and to make our case and to engage in a dialogue and engage in a debate with others. And that's part of what it means to be a citizen who is also a believer. A believer is also a citizen. And that's part of what it means about a search for coming to know some good in common as a society that we cannot know alone. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Good night.